This program may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Derek walks you through how to win government jobs and contracts, effectively manage your government career, and best utilize government services. Every week on Fed Access, you'll learn about interesting federal agencies, workers, and jobs. Fed Access provides you the access you need to succeed in the federal government. And now your host, Derek T. Dortch.
We're going to be talking about historic preservation. I have with me the executive director for ACHP, and that's the Advisory Council for Historic Preservation, John Fowler. He's the executive director of this organization, which is a federal agency in charge of historic preservation around the country. And they also do some stuff international that we'll talk about as well. John, thank you for joining me.
Pleasure to be here.
Tell us about what your organization does.
The Advisory Council on Historic Preservation is unique. It's a small federal agency that was established by the Congress in 1966 to provide leadership in the federal government for historic preservation. And it's comprised of a cabinet-level council of 23 members. We have 8 citizens appointed by the president. We have 9 federal agencies, the architect of the Capitol, a governor, a mayor, the president of the National Conference of State Historic Preservation Officers, the chairman of the National Trust for Historic Preservation, and a Native American or Native Hawaiian appointed by the president. And as a group, they meet on a quarterly basis. And then we, the staff, and there are 36 of us headquartered here in Washington, do their work during the remainder of the year. Our primary charge is to advise the president and Congress on historic preservation matters, which gets us into a lot of issues where historic preservation intersects with contemporary needs such as energy development, high-speed rail, so on and so forth. And then we are our primary bread and butter is administering the federal government's protections for historic properties, and these are found in Section 106 of the National Historic Preservation Act.
Is that when you talk about Section 106, and we'll get into that a little bit more, but we're talking about whenever somebody sees a kind of a maybe a plaque on a federal, not even federal building, but a historic building saying that this place has been designated as a historic site, is that what Section 106 deals with?
Section 106 is tees off of the National Register of Historic Places. And the National Register, which is maintained by the National Park Service, has over 80,000 individual listings of historic properties that are significant at the national, state, and local level. So where you see a plaque, that's not always indicative of a property being on the National Register.
Okay.
It might be a plaque somebody went and bought at Home Depot.
Sure. Right.
Or it might be a plaque that was given out by the Secretary of Interior to a National Historic Landmark, which are really the crown jewels of American cultural heritage.
How do we define historic?
Well, that's an excellent question. The National Park Service has specified criteria based on what's in the statute for determining properties eligible for the National Register, and which means in the eyes of the federal government, they're historically significant. So properties can be significant in American history, architecture, archaeology, culture, or engineering. They can be significant at the national, state, and local level. And as I mentioned, of the 80,000 listings that are on the National Register, only about maybe 10,000 of those are recognized as significant at the national level.
Okay.
So most of the historic properties that we see—
That means recognized by the federal government.
Right. Well, recognized as significant to the nation as a whole,
okay,
such as a Mount Vernon or a Monticello, a Mesa Verde, something like that. Most properties that are recognized to be historic are properties that are important to local communities. A neighborhood like Cleveland Park, Georgetown, so on, these are things that define the local community, and they are significant at the local level. And a historic property can be an individually listed property, like a courthouse or a railroad station. It can be an archaeological site. It can be a district, such as the main street of a small town in Iowa. Many of those are listed on the National Register. In fact, there are over 1,500, I think, historic districts listed on the National Register. And that brings the total of properties that fall within the protections of the National Register to over 1 million properties nationwide.
What does that mean if you're in a National Registry?
Well, this is one of the major misconceptions of the program.
Okay.
Being listed on the National Register from a protection side means that Section 106, which we'll talk about, applies to any federal action that might impact the historic property. The Federal Highway Administration is going to fund road improvements that are going to go through a historic farm. Well, it triggers a review process, which, as we'll talk about, does not give anybody the authority to say yes or no to whether that property is impaired or not. But National Register listing qualifies a property for federal assistance. And if you're a commercial property, the federal government has a 20% investment tax credit for the rehabilitation of historic properties that is a very, very strong financial incentive for reinvestment.
So for commercial developers, if they do maybe either build around or improve a site,
yeah, right. If they use a historic building and they can add on to it, but they have to do it in a way that preserves the historic integrity of the building. And you see these projects all over the country. It generates more than $4 billion worth of private investment each year. It's a great driver for jobs. It has been one of the most successful producers of low and moderate income housing units.
Sure.
Because developers will twin the historic preservation tax credit with the low income credit and get a really good subsidy, basically, to do their project. But to go back to your basic question, the listing on the National Register has no impact on your property rights as a property owner. You can do whatever you want with your property. You can tear it down. You can add on to it. You can remodel it. The only time that federal law is triggered is if you are getting some kind of federal assistance or you're getting some kind of federal approval.
Okay.
Now, historic properties that are on the National Register are often listed on local landmarks list. And local preservation designation, such as in the District of Columbia, we have a very rigorous historic preservation law. So if you want to modify your house in Cleveland Park, which is on the National Register, but which is also locally listed, you have to go through an approval process through the D.C. Historic Preservation Review Board in order to do exterior alterations.
Okay.
But that's all a matter of local law.
Now, it behooves really maybe an older town or something like that, because maybe I'm assuming that every older town is not necessarily on a national registry. They can apply to maybe be on this process. Is that correct?
The way it works is that there's the key public figure in the Historic Preservation Program is somebody called the State Historic Preservation Officer.
Okay.
The SHPO.
With the SHPO, this person, they get federal money to go around and do these surveys?
They have a federal matching grant.
Okay.
That supports their office, and they, in addition to the surveys, they manage the tax credit program, so they do the initial reviews. If you're a developer, you come to the SHPO and say, here are my plans, this is what I want to do.
And then they will pay for it.
If the developer... that's an interesting question. I'm not sure. There's a review fee for doing tax act reviews that they can charge the developer, but I don't think they can charge the developer for doing
the
nomination.
Survey. Okay, the nomination.
Although it's possible that some developers come in and say, here's my nomination because
sure.
I want to move it through here, and they've already gotten a consultant to
okay.
do it.
Okay, because we want to kind of keep it as an unbiased approach and not have it influenced by the developer, so to speak.
Right, because what the SHPO does is they take the National Register criteria and they say, does this building meet the criteria? So, and then they advance it as a nomination. And the SHPO is also the key figure in the Section 106 process because they're the ones that are really the shock troops dealing with the review of these federal projects.
Got it. We're talking about the Advisory Council for Historic Preservation, ACHP. I've been speaking with John Fowler. He's the executive director of this organization. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Deutsch on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
The Federal Drive is every weekday from 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Hear interviews, news, perspective, and analysis from Tom Temin and Amy Morris. The Federal Drive team will help give you the important information you need about the federal government and how it impacts your organization or agency. Tune in 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. or go to federalnewsradio.com. The Federal Drive is sponsored by CDWG. The right technology, right away.
Your Army Computing Refresh calls for someone who knows the terrain. As a trusted supplier to the U.S. Army for over six decades, Hewlett-Packard is a name you can count on. HP offers a broad range of desktops, notebooks, and workstations at special ADMC2 prices. And they include efficiency features, like the all-new 2010 Intel Core i5 processor with Intel Turbo Boost technology. See the full range of solutions now at hp.com/HP for Army.
If you work for or have worked for the federal government, I want to tell you about an organization that's been around for over 80 years. It's NARF. Organized in 1921 to protect and enhance the retirement and health benefits of federal employees. NARF wants you to know that laws can change and so can your retirement security. Protect it by joining NARF, the only association that's dedicated to making sure your retirement is secure when you reach retirement. Don't wait until after you retire to join NARF. Check out their website at www.narfe.org. You'll see that NARF is a great investment for your retirement future. Then click on the Join Now button and join hundreds of thousands of federal retirees and employees as a NARF member. That's www.narfe.org. Or call 1-800-627-3394 and ask them to send you some information. Join now. NARF, your best retirement investment.
And now Ask the CIO, brought to you by Vion Corporation.
Jim Warren is the CIO of the Recovery, Accountability, and Transparency Board in the Office of Management and Budget. He describes some of the changes coming to recovery.gov.
We are exploring new widgets so states and other organizations can harvest specific pieces of our data and post it on their own recovery websites. And finally, we are planning to add a section, Recovery in Action. That section will provide civics lessons to the American public on how government works. Phenomenal future ahead for recovery.gov.
Data is exploding in growth, usage, and retention. Count on it. And count on Vion to manage your organization through that change. Vion's file service solutions allow you to manage all platforms with an integrated management approach. This enables you to consolidate, protect, search, and archive unstructured data. With powerful technology partners like Hitachi Data Systems, Vion will help you regain control of your IT environment. To learn more about Vion's file services, visit Vion.com. That's Vion.com.
Welcome back. If you just joined us, we've been talking about the historic preservation, and we've been talking about the Advisory Council. And I was corrected on this over the break by John. The Advisory Council, make sure I got this right, John, Advisory Council on Historic Preservation. Is that right?
Correct.
And I was saying for historic preservation. And there was a reason for that. There's a reason why the name is. I'm trying to change the name of the agency. But
the mission of the ACHP is to accommodate new development and public projects that federal agencies are sponsoring that have legitimate public interests with historic preservation. So our goal is to promote preservation, but to do it in a way that allows a federal project to go forward. So we try and strike a balance between preservation and development. And you take one of our major partners, which is the National Trust for Historic Preservation, which is a national nonprofit membership organization, and they are an advocacy organization. So we often joke at each other about the difference of our middle names.
But you work closely together.
Very closely. The chairman is a member of the council.
Now, with all of that, we've been talking about this Section 106. And Section 106 really comes out of the National Historic Preservation Act?
Correct, of 1966.
Break that down. What's this act about? And then what is Section 106 that we've been speaking about?
The act is really the foundation of the federal program for preservation in the United States. It created the ACHP. It created the National Register of Historic Places. It created the State Historic Preservation Officer. It provided grants for the federal government to support preservation in the states and in localities. It led to the tax incentives that came about a number of years later. But it really defines the National Historic Preservation Program. It sets out responsibilities for federal agencies, both in Section 106 and then in another section, Section 110, that has a laundry list of obligations federal agencies have for managing historic preservation issues within their agencies. And if you're a federal property manager, then there are obligations that federal property managers have for maintaining their buildings in a manner consistent with the historic significance of those buildings.
Now, with that whole process, with 106, that, and it kind of, like you said, it kind of laid the groundwork for really all historic preservation operations, including your organization mm-hmm. as well. With this whole mandate, I mean, does that mean that you guys go about, you know, looking throughout the whole nation? I know the surveys are being done, but with that includes protection of all historic property. That includes all of this, right?
Well, right. And the National Park Service administers most of the program.
Okay.
They provide the grants to the states. They do the certifications regarding Tax Act rehabilitations. They set the standards. There's something called the Secretary's Standards for Rehabilitation, and those have become really the Bible in the United States for what is acceptable preservation practice for dealing with historic buildings.
Okay.
Many of these are the standards are incorporated into local regulations, and so they really have become pervasive. So the Section 106 process is really our piece of the pie, and that is the intersection between federal agencies, their development projects, and the historic environment.
Okay. With these development projects, and you know, and like you said, you've seen billions of dollars come through these development projects. We saw some different partnerships of some different projects you have on your website. What are some of the main projects that you guys have overseen that you have that say, listen, this is our pride and joy in terms of historic preservation, possibly a combination of development and everything else?
Well, let me make clear at the outset that Tax Act projects are not something that go through the 106 process.
Okay.
Those are projects that are designed to be good for the historic building, and they're overseen by the Secretary of the Interior. So we set up basically an exemption from Section 106 for those privately funded projects. What we see through Section 106 are projects that are directly federally funded, like the General Services Administration building a new courthouse, the federal assisted projects like highways or rail systems, Recovery Act projects. Those all go through the Section 106 process, and then probably the most challenging area is those projects that have a federal license. So we had a big controversy over cell towers a number of years ago that we worked through. We're dealing now with
and with that controversy. I mean, break it down for us.
Well, okay. So with the emergence of the cell industry, mm-hmm. all of a sudden, as you recall, there was a proliferation of cell towers all over the landscape. So if you put a cell tower on a historic building, you can impair the integrity, the historic integrity of the building. If you put a cell tower in the viewshed of a Civil War battlefield, if you go to Antietam, the environment around Antietam, when you stand on the battlefield, you see no 20th century intrusion.
Sure.
You see a landscape that's very much like it was in September of 1862. There was a proposal to put a cell tower on the ridgeline that was right in the viewshed of the Antietam battlefield. Through the 106 process, it was negotiated so that the cell tower was moved down the hill so that it did not reach above the tree line. So okay. It was pretty much disguised.
Okay.
So that's the kind of thing. And the problem, the challenge when you're dealing with these licensed projects is that there's no federal money involved. So if you're going to come up with a solution and there's a cost to that, the developer has to bear the cost.
Gotcha.
And so that makes it harder. The 106 process is based on negotiation and compromise. And compromise for preservation often has a price tag on it.
And are you seeing a lot more of, I don't know what it's called, a headbutting, but are you kind of seeing historic preservation coming up against the pressures of we want to put in a new development, a new housing development?
I would say, I mean, I've been doing this since the 70s, and I would say that there's a far greater awareness and acceptance of historic values in the historic environment, and that the consideration of historic values has become routinized in planning now. And so, sure, there are controversies all the time. You know, there's a lot of talk now about it. Walmart at the Wilderness Battlefield, right on the fringe of the Wilderness Battlefield. It's a big local controversy.
Right.
but the process incorporates the issues. In other words, people can, they know they have to deal with it. You get into some pretty tough negotiations, and in the end, because the process is advisory, it's up to the agency what they do. But people don't run away from it. People don't do as much subverting the process, you know, just ignoring the process the way they used to. So I think that they confront it. There's still challenges, but it's accepted as something, just like the National Environmental Policy
Sure.
Act.
And I know that one of your mainstays, one of your main projects is kind of, you know, kind of education, outreach. And is that part of it, is kind of getting out to, whether it be federal agencies
Right.
or commercial, you know, development properties and everything else, and educating people about Section 106 and how to utilize it?
Right. That's, I mean, that's one of our our biggest products, is doing training for participants, whether they be federal, state, local officials, or consultants that deal with developers. Our website is has a wealth of information about Section 106. It has examples of cases. How do you use it? It has a citizen's guide. We do a lot of work with Indian tribes. There's a guide for consulting with Indian tribes on preservation issues. So, you know, if people want to learn more, www.achp.gov.
That's where you got to go.
That's right.
And do you got, I mean, does your team go out? I mean, or do you have all your training here, or do your team go out as a mobile training team?
We do about 10 on-site training courses a year. You can see where they are from the website. We are starting to get into distance learning, and because we realize that with 36 staff members, we don't have the capacity to cover the earth.
Right.
But we can do more if we use the web.
You know, you mentioned about your 36 staff, and I just kind of want to give maybe a overview of who's part of your team. I mean, is it a team of historians, a team of technical people, engineers?
It's,
I mean, what's it composed of?
It's a mixed bag. We have a number of a small number of architects, archaeologists, historians, planners, a lawyer or two, and there's a growing field of historic preservation specialists, which are people that have graduate degrees working in the administrative end of historic preservation. They know how to deal with the laws. They know how to deal with the conflict issues that come up, but they may not be a registered architect or a professional archaeologist.
Okay, outstanding. We'll be talking about the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation. I'm talking to John Fowler. He is the executive director of this organization. He's been with the organization for, what, 30 years, John?
Since 72.
Well, I don't want to age you, so you're looking well. But you're listening to Derek T. Dortch on Fed Access. You listen to Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
The Internet. It's indispensable. Without it, how else would we perform crucial functions like shoe shopping, watching videos of a cat playing the piano, emailing inspirational anecdotes to our 1,000 closest friends? But despite these awesome utilizations of information technology at Kaiser Permanente, we've found some better uses. Like being able to securely manage your own health online 24/7, emailing your doctor's office, checking most test results, reviewing meds, making routine appointments, not to mention a vital digital connection between you, your doctor, and everyone on your team. Could it be that making total health smarter, more efficient, and more convenient is the very sort of thing for which the internet was intended? Maybe, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't fit in a cat video now and then. We're Kaiser Permanente, and we want you to live well, laugh well, and thrive. Learn more at kp.org/thrive.
Kaiser Foundation Health Plan of the Mid-Atlantic States Incorporated, 2101 East Jefferson Street, Rockville, Maryland, 20852.
Video teleconferencing solutions are changing the way people communicate by breaking down the walls and enabling face-to-face communication, regardless of distance or environment. Tanberg developed Break Down the Walls to provide a window into the ways government, education, and healthcare organizations are using VTC solutions to help them operate more effectively and efficiently, and the ways video solutions can be used to address challenges facing public sector organizations today. Learn more at breakdownthewalls.com.
Advancing your IT career is anything but a game, which is why UMBC is the only university in Maryland to offer graduate programs in human-centered computing, a program on the leading edge that examines how people interact with technology through the study of computing, behavioral sciences, and design. Not only for IT professionals, the program is also designed for those in fields such as psychology, journalism, and marketing. Get the credential that makes a difference. Find out more about human-centered computing at hcc.umbc.edu. Today.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas.
Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you just joined us, we're talking about historic preservation today, and we're talking about the agency that handles historic preservation for the United States, the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation. I have with me in the studio John Fowler. He's the executive director of ACHP. John, we were talking over the break about some of the major projects that your agency has worked with or worked on in terms of kind of historic preservation. I know a couple you mentioned, and I'll start off with this one. It's St. Elizabeth. What's that about?
Well, let me make one sort of introductory observation on that. There are over 100,000 cases a year that go through the 106 process. Most of those are handled between the State Historic Preservation Officer and the federal agency. We only see about 1,500 a year.
Okay.
So
Am I assuming that when you see them, it's more of a major scenario?
Right. They're either complicated issues, particularly significant properties, public controversy, so on and so forth. St. Elizabeth's is a place that's known to many in the Washington area. It's a National Historic Landmark. It was on the cutting edge of mental health treatment from the middle of the 19th century on, and then as we changed our views on dealing with the mentally ill, it became unused. It's a large campus in Southeast Washington that has some very significant buildings. It looks a bit like a college campus. It's a National Historic Landmark for its association with the history of mental health, and it's one of the most amazing parcels of land in the District of Columbia. If you're at St. E's and you look out over the district, you have this incredible view.
Yeah.
There's a Civil War cemetery there and so on. One of the big challenges for the future of St. E's has been, what are you going to do with it? And so when the Department of Homeland Security came looking for a headquarters, and they went to GSA, and GSA and DHS got together and said, okay, we can use the St. E's campus because it's already a secure, walled-in facility,
right.
And it has the space to be the DHS headquarters. But to do that, in addition to renovating existing buildings, DHS had to insert a sizable amount of new office space, parking, et cetera. Because this was federal action, federal construction, DHS, GSA had to go through the Section 106 process. Because it was a National Historic Landmark, because it was a controversial project, it came to the attention of the ACHP. So we ended up in the negotiations with the other federal agencies on it. The Department of Transportation through FHWA was involved because there was an access road and interchange change, and the National Park Service would have to approve some parkland uses in order to provide access to the site. So we managed this protracted, but in the end, I think, very successful negotiation process that came up with standards and agreements for rehabilitating the major buildings, historic buildings at St. Elizabeth's to be used for contemporary office space, that set the parameters and design guidelines for all the new construction so that it would they would be worked into the historic landscape. And
what you're saying is that many of the historic buildings at St. Elizabeth right now will now be changed over. Externally, they will look the same, possibly. Internally, they will be changed over to kind of be now contemporary offices.
Right.
Maybe some parts of them will they, you know, kind of still keep a historic part of it in terms of museum-like to close it off? Or how is that going to work?
Well, that's an interesting aspect of it. The original building at St. Elizabeth's has some very distinctive features. It has the cell, the room that Ezra Pound was kept in. I believe that one of the outcomes will be to preserve one of those essentially as a museum. What was the superintendent's office and so on will be restored, and the office complex in the oldest building will be restored as the secretary's office. But by and large, the interior spaces are being treated very flexibly to meet contemporary office standards.
Okay.
And this has also been designated by GSA and the Council on Environmental Quality to be a model project for sustainable office development of historic buildings by the federal government.
Okay.
Now, all of that sounds that it was, you know, a smooth sailing, peachy keen, so on and so forth. But there was some strong preservation opposition to it. And the National Trust for Historic Preservation was concerned about the intensity of new development.
In terms of new buildings,
right,
too
many
parking.
New buildings and on the site. And in the end, they were not completely satisfied with the outcome. They appreciated the fact that this was going to be a major federal investment, would renovate the buildings, but they were still concerned about the level of new construction.
Because the impact in that area is going to be great. I mean, you've got basically every Homeland Security agency, Coast Guard,
right,
CPB, and TSA, everybody's going to be moving onto that campus.
Right.
And then that's a number of bigger buildings being built within that realm.
But they're being built in a way that respects the scale.
Okay.
And they're sited on the landscape in a way that makes them feel part of the campus as opposed to an intrusion. And that's what the 106 process is all about, is how do you accommodate new construction and renovation to end up with a net gain for preservation? Because if DHS had not come in and said, we'll take the whole thing, those buildings would rot away.
Okay.
So we view that as a big preservation success.
And you mentioned about kind of the National Park Service coming in and kind of saying we're going to, put a piece of this
to visit? There's something called Shepherd Parkway, which they're still, and the Park Service is concerned about this. They're not in full agreement on it, but there needs to be some road realignments in order to get from Suitland Parkway into the site.
Okay.
And so that's not completely hammered out yet. So it's part of that negotiation process.
Yeah.
Of bringing everybody to go.
And the St. Elizabeth process, when is it expected to be online? I know there's already kind of...
Well, they're already under construction.
And
they're
it should doing, be finished when?
Ooh, I am... This is
estimated
a multi-year...
Time.
I don't know. This may be 5 years out.
Okay.
The new construction for the Coast Guard building is underway. And then I think the next step is the renovation of the headquarters building.
Now, during the time period when things are being kind of renovated and there's construction going on, are you, ACHP, are you guys involved in kind of oversight to make sure that what has been agreed on is still kind of, you know, being, I mean, do you monitor?
Not very much. We're a little bit like the Lone Ranger.
Okay.
You know, we sort of ride off into the sunset after the agreement is struck. We look to the State Historic Preservation Officer. We look to local preservation groups to say, hey, there's a problem. There's usually in these agreements, there's usually some kind of reporting mechanism so we know what's going on.
Okay.
But we don't have the capacity to police now, these things.
Given this, and this may be a silly question, but D.C. not being a state, so to say, does it have its own historic preservation officer?
Okay.
So they're the one who would be responsible for kind of going onto the property, making sure everything is being adhered to through 106.
Right. Well, and what happens with particularly something like St. Elizabeth's is there are subsidiary review processes when they get to doing the plans and specs for the renovation of the main building. That'll be reviewed by the state historic preservation officer.
Okay.
And if there's a problem, there's a kick-out clause that brings it back to us.
Okay. So only if it's a major problem, then somebody come back to you guys, and then you go back to the negotiation table, or that
well, we come back in and try and get people to agree what the outcome should be.
Okay.
You know, if it means modifications, so on and so forth. In the end, though, we're only advisory.
Okay.
So if the agency says, no, we got to do it this way, all we can say is, well, we think you should do it that way, but it's your decision.
Now, given that you are advisory and you're advisory to the president, I mean, can you say that, listen, we're concerned about this and bump it up to the executive, you know, executive level? And I mean,
we have done that twice in the history of the organization.
Okay.
And these were major highway projects in California that had tremendous impacts, and we felt that they should not go forward. The agency said, thank you very much for your advice. We're going to go forward with it. We said, we're going to take this to the President's Council on Environmental Quality.
We're talking about historic preservation, and we're talking about the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation. Have with me in the studio John Fowler. He's the executive director of ACHP and a historian himself of the agency because he's been there for about 30 years, and the organization started in the 60s, and you came in the 70s. So you've got some good backdrop on what this agency has been about for the last few years. You're listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Things just don't happen. You need a plan. A federal career can last 30 years or more, and so can federal retirement. Tune in each Monday at 10 a.m. to get the information you need to plan your course for financial security, solid benefits, and optimum health care. 100% focused on the federal employee for your benefit. Presented by NITP has the answers to your mid-career and retirement planning questions. Listen to For Your Benefit Mondays at 10 a.m. on 1500 a.m. Federal News Radio for an hour that can change your future.
This is the sound of a data center. While all data center networks might sound alike, they're not. You see, most are horribly complex and expensive to manage. Now, this is a Juniper network. Hear the difference? That's the sound of Juniper's simplified, automated, and secure solutions efficiently humming along, delivering you better performance at lower costs using less power. Music to my ears, and proof that while all data center networks might sound alike, they don't all work alike. Juniper Networks. Learn more at thenewnetworkishere.com.
The latest from the Federal Security Spotlight brought to you by Cisco.
One department takes a market approach to cybersecurity. Here's John Strafert, Chief Information Security Officer at State.
What we've tried to do in terms of security is to deal with the high volume of information and then begin acting like a market would of increasing the number of points charged for an uncorrected vulnerability when they show up and deduct points when someone takes care of a problem.
To hear the entire show, log on to federalnewsradio.com. Will the top-of-mind security issues of today be the issues facing government tomorrow? Get the latest from federal experts on FISMA reform, the cyber initiative, how government is combating botnets, spyware, and other cyber evils, and more. Listen to Federal Security Spotlight, sponsored by Cisco, airing Thursday from 10 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. on Federal News Radio 1500 a.m. or on demand at federalnewsradio.com. The Federal Security Spotlight is brought to you by Cisco, the leader in federal IT security.
Announcing Executive Update 2010, the Senior Executives Association, in affiliation with Deloitte Federal Human Capital Practice, invites you to join your peers in government June 16th in Washington, D.C. for Executive Update 2010. Sessions focus on the administration's performance expectations for executives, labor management forums, OPM Director John Barry's vision for the Career Executive Corps, Norm Ornstein's congressional election predictions, and much more. For additional information and to register, visit seniorexecutives.org.
It's time to get real. Only one of the aerial refueling tankers offered to the U.S. Air Force is flying now and ready for our troops today. It's EADS North America's KC-45. America's warfighters deserve a proven, more capable aircraft that's performing now. And the EADS North America KC-45 will be made in the U.S. by 48,000 Americans. They're ready to get to work, and the Air Force is ready for a real tanker. See it at kc45now.com.
The Pentagon and Beyond, brought to you by Air Inc.
Canadian police are looking for a man who illegally bought enough ammonium nitrate to make a large bomb. There is significant concern about the purchase because Canada's hosting the Group of Eight Summit and the G20 later this month. Police found out about it after a farm supply store in southern Canada notified them. The man is described by police as being in his 50s or 60s with brown, unkempt hair and missing fingers on his right hand. Missing fingers are often the telltale sign of an experienced bomb maker. I'm J.J. Green.
When you fly over the North Pole, do you ever think about how remote you are? Air Inc. does, and that's why they have it covered. They're the only company in the world that provides high-frequency data links so that pilots can always communicate with someone on the ground. Air Inc. ensures you're never alone at 35,000 feet. For more information and career opportunities, log on to ARINC.com.
Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio 1500. We're talking about historic preservation, and we're talking about the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation. I have with me John Fowler. He's the executive director of ACHP. Over the break, we were talking about, John, and you were saying that you guys have your hands in almost everything. I mean, anything historic that deals with the government, about the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, the Martin Luther King Memorial, anything that's going on that can provide some kind of historic context, you guys are involved in.
Right. Through the 106 process, the SHPOs are, and then the tough ones come into our lap.
Definitely. We talked about some other major projects that have been maybe kind of a demonstration of what your agency is involved in. What was the next one that you were mentioning?
Well, let me use two examples. One just recently turned out to have a happy ending. And it also demonstrates kind of the breadth of the National Register. There is a dirigible hangar at Moffett Field in California, outside of San Jose, that was built in the 1930s to house an airship. And obviously, we don't have airships anymore. There's no use for it. It's a tremendous structure. It's huge. It's supposedly visible from space. And it is a local landmark. It's an engineering landmark. And it had been under the jurisdiction of the Navy, and they had no further use for it, and it needed to be remediated for hazardous materials. And it was being transferred, the site was being transferred to NASA. And NASA had some ideas about how to use it, but the challenge was it needed to have the skin removed, which was impregnated with asbestos.
Okay.
Needed to have the skin removed, and then the question was, okay, can you reskin it? Yes, you can, and maintain its historic integrity.
So NASA saw the use of maybe building kind of, you know, space vehicles.
Because it's a huge open interior space,
sure,
I mean,
sure.
Covered space. It has its own microclimate inside because it's so large.
That large.
So but the question was, okay, it was technologically feasible to reskin it. The question was, who's going to pay for it? And you could imagine NASA, Navy pointing fingers at each other. But in the end, through the Section 106 process, number one, there was a commitment to retain the building and to restore it. And number two, through the continued negotiations, it's now being worked out that the money is being found to reskin the building.
And the money's being, and who decided to pay? I mean, who?
Well, it's being negotiated between the Navy and NASA.
Okay, so
they had a little help from the Congress in sort of encouraging them to reach a solution.
Okay. It's what I'm seeing. I'm looking at a picture of it right now. It is a massive structure. Is what I'm seeing the finished product?
That's the way it is now.
Okay.
But when it's through, it'll look like that.
It'll look like this.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. And so this is really a matter of, and you guys were, because it was historic property, you guys negotiated with these two
right.
agencies on how this should look, what would be the layout and everything else.
Yeah, what was going to be, you know, what was going to be the outcome of the remediation? Were they going to tear it down completely? There was a proposal to just save the skeleton, the frame, and the local community wanted to see it reskinned. The other case that I wanted to talk about, because I think it demonstrates the challenges that we have in the 106 process, is the recent Cape Wind Project. This is the first offshore wind farm in Nantucket Sound. It's 130, 440-foot tall wind turbines that are in the viewshed, and that's often kind of a squidgy concept, of 16 historic districts on Cape Cod. and Martha's Vineyard. Nantucket Island, which is a National Historic Landmark, the whole island. The Kennedy Compound, which is a National Historic Landmark. And there are 12 individually significant properties and that are affected by the project. And the National Register determined that Nantucket Sound itself was eligible for the National Register because the seabed was originally, 7,000 years ago, was dry land, and so it's likely to contain archaeological sites from Native Americans. And there are two Indian tribes that have lands on Cape Cod, and their traditional religious practices are oriented towards the rising of the sun, the moon, and so on the eastern horizon. And this wind farm would be right in the middle, right in their intersect with where they would view the rising of the sun. Very controversial project. It certainly great value. Nothing, you know, as we know from recent events, could be a higher national priority than to develop clean energy sources. This is the first one out of the gates, but it had been in the process of planning for 9 years. And unfortunately, there wasn't really serious consideration given to the historic impacts until very late in the process.
Okay.
And there were changes in jurisdiction from the Corps of Engineers to MMS and so on and so on and so forth. But anyway, this was one of those cases where we could not get...
So you came in late in the process.
Yeah, because we were brought in. The whole process, 106 process, was brought in late. But we could not reach agreement. There was no... The developer was not willing to go to an alternative site. The preservation community and we felt that the impacts were too great where they were. So in those circumstances, what we do is comment to the head of the agency. So we sent a panel of our presidentially appointed members up, public meeting, so on and so forth, and they issued comments to the Secretary of the Interior recommending that the project not be approved.
Okay.
And rather that they look for alternative sites. And the Secretary, exercising his prerogative, said, appreciate your concerns. I understand your comments. It's imperative that we move forward with this project, and so I'm going to approve it.
Okay.
Now, that's the what that demonstrates is the not only the challenges of preservation versus certain kinds of development projects, it also shows you the limits on federal preservation laws. Because in the end, there's nobody but the secretary that could say no to that project. Okay. Based on its preservation impact.
Given that you guys are advisory, I mean, do you feel that federal laws need to be made stronger?
I think that the process has become well enough entrenched in federal planning that it does a good job and it rarely ends up at that advisory point. We only have maybe 3 to 5 cases a year where we end up in the advisory mode.
Okay.
But at the same time, I would say that we are...
But it sounds like those are big cases, though. I mean, well, the impact is heavy.
Yeah, they're important cases. But if you look at the 100,000 mm-hmm. that get worked out, then that says to me the system's working pretty well. I'd make two observations on that. One is when you compare our approach to preservation regulation with, say, Europe, we're, you know, way behind the curve.
Okay.
But you have a different heritage about regulation of private property, centralized planning, so on and so forth.
Well, I know you're involved heavily on the international side as well in terms of kind of looking at the EU and kind of just being in the international side of historic preservation. When you kind of say that we're kind of behind on the curve of historic preservation as Europe, who is, you know, they always make sure that, you know, churches are preserved and everything else is preserved. Where should we go in terms of benchmarking?
Well, I think we have a lot to learn from European examples. We have to incorporate them into the American approach to private property rights, the respective roles of federal, state, and local government. But there are things we can learn simply in practice. For example, in the wake of the Cape Wind project, I was at a meeting of cultural heritage and landscape professionals, government officials, and in France, and asked them for examples of guidelines on siting of wind farms. And several people came up to me and said, well, we have this in Tuscany, and we've just done this in Slovakia. And I think there are best practices that we can adopt and share with industry and share with other government agencies that are not regulatory, but rather just good planning. And that's what our goal is, because in the end, we don't have a club. And what we're trying to do is show an agency, a developer, you can achieve your goal, but you can do it in a way that advances historic preservation or at least minimizes harm. So that's what we're all about.
We're talking about the Advisory Council for Historic Preservation, ACHP. I've been speaking with John Fowler. He's the executive director of this organization. Thank you for coming on the show.
Love to do it. Thank you.
You've been listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear it in its entirety on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch, Friday afternoons at noon, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, WFED. Your source for federal news now.
Federal agencies are reaping the benefits of desktop virtualization. They're reducing TCO, lowering energy consumption, creating an agile infrastructure, and opening the way for cloud computing. How do you make sense of the changing desktop landscape? Tune in June 16th at 11 a.m. to hear experts from GTSI, HP, Microsoft, and Citrix discuss the growing movement to virtualize desktops. Don't miss the panel discussion on how to jumpstart your desktop virtualization initiative, Wednesday, June 16th at 11 a.m. on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m.
Please join the American Federation of Government Employees for its series, Inside Government. The weekly program gives you the real story on what's happening inside federal agencies and the rights of federal employees. Hear the latest from the nation's top lawmakers, celebrities, journalists, union leaders, and federal workers. Don't miss AFGE's Inside Government, Friday at 10 a.m., right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m.
Here's Chris Kemp, Chief Technology Officer, NASA, on the Federal Executive Forum on Secure Cloud Computing, sponsored by SafeNet.
I foresee some sort of federal app store, whether it's apps.gov or the local policy skins that exist, various agencies that will allow their employees to provision apps through apps.gov, and making the most innovative applications and services available to the employees.
To listen to the whole program made possible by Trezza Media Group, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
From defending our nation's borders to protecting the environment, cloud computing services can support your mission and serve the American public. Trust your information in the cloud with SafeNet's data-centric solutions that enable security, privacy, and compliance. SafeNet Solutions allows agencies to share sensitive data throughout the information lifecycle, from the battle space to the White House. SafeNet has been at the core of data protection for more than 25 years. Visit safenet-inc.com/government.
What is the Secure Communities Program? How is U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement transforming how it identifies and removes criminal aliens from the U.S.? What about its efforts to improve information sharing with its law enforcement partners? The Business of Government Hour will explore these questions and more with David Venturella, Executive Director, Secure Communities Program within the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Join host Michael Keegan next week on the Business of Government Hour.
Video teleconferencing solutions are changing the way people communicate by breaking down the walls and enabling face-to-face communication, regardless of distance or environment. Tanberg developed Break Down the Walls to provide a window into the ways government, education, and healthcare organizations are using VTC solutions to help them operate more effectively and efficiently, and the ways video solutions can be used to address challenges facing public sector organizations today. Learn more at breakdownthewalls.com.
WFED Washington.